Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, and it is the 4th of April, 2012, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line once again by our old friend Tom Secker of InvestigatingTheTerror.com. And Tom Secker is an absolute veritable fount of knowledge on all things related to 7-7 and many other aspects of the terror war on terror paradigm that we've been suffering through for at least a decade. So, Tom, it's always great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Good to talk to you again, James.
All right. Well, it's great to talk to you. I always enjoy our conversations. As I say, you're one of my favorite researchers out there. You've done so much great research, especially on 7-7, obviously. So let's start talking about some of your recent work, or really a subject that I know that you've been working on for a while. And in fact, much to the chagrin of some of the people out there, it's not related to your work on spy pigeons, but I know that's a popular article on your website right now, but let's talk about something different. So what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I mean, you remember in not our last conversation, but the previous one, when we did that piece on 7-7 that you put together for GRTV, and we were discussing this whole question of predictive programming, particularly with relation to 7-7, but, you know, we got a little bit broader than that on the subject. And you asked me, you know, where do you go with this? It's certainly a fascinating, if slightly sort of kooky and bizarre idea, but it's a sort of kooky and bizarre idea that when you look into it, you mysteriously find that there is a lot of evidence that this is actually going on. Exactly how and exactly why, very difficult things to pin down at this stage, but that it is a real phenomenon, that something is actually happening here, whereby certain major events, and in particular terrorist attacks, are being not only foreseen but preempted in so many ways by these television programs and films and also books and other media as well. And you asked me, where do you go with this idea? And I didn't know the answer. And I'm not entirely sure I have the answer yet, but that's something I've been looking more and more into, particularly since I started the new website. So I suppose, I mean, there's lots of different angles we can take into this. So we should probably, I mean, let's start with a sort of relatively simple and straightforward example of how this sort of material is used for propagandistic purposes. Have you ever seen the film or read the book Topaz, the spy story Topaz?
I can't say as I have, no.
Well, fair enough. You don't have as much time for these things as I evidently have. But yeah, I mean,
is that a
the
Hitchcock?
Book written in? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I've seen almost everything Hitchcock has ever done, but I think not that one.
Well, it is curious, actually, just how much of this stuff involves Hitchcock films. I mean, as we were talking about before, there's this film Sabotage in the 1930s, which is somewhat based on a real event, but at the same time could be seen as a sort of predictive programming with regards to 7-7. It depicts this sort of quasi-suicide bomber on a bus, a guy who doesn't know he's carrying a bomb, but the bomb explodes and kills him and kills everyone on the bus. And obviously this is, you know, people have thought that could be what was going on with 7-7. A lot of this does involve Hitchcock's work. He's like Kubrick in that respect. There's a lot of these same ideas and from the same, almost the same filmmaking period. Hitchcock, I suppose, is a little earlier, but just one of those directors that film after film after film, you can find something in there that is obviously relating back to what's really going on, that these aren't just, you know, grand stories, grand cinematic stories, that there's a bit more to it than that. But yeah, Topaz, very quickly, it's a 1960s spy novel set in 62 around Cuba, after the Bay of Pigs, Cuban Missile Crisis, that whole context there. The film was made, I don't know, a year or two later. I think the book is 67, the film's 68, 69. And yeah, and it's made by Hitchcock. And it's a very good spy thriller. Very, very watchable film. The book is so-so. I mean, Leon Uris as an author is known for being a bit of a Zionist, and his Zionism certainly leaks through in a few rather obvious places in a couple of his books that I've read. And the curious thing about it is that the storyline is based around the Americans using a French agent to discover the Russians attempting to move these missiles into Cuba. And there is also, as a separate plot, the Topaz is a Russian spy ring situated in French intelligence who is leaking information back to the Russians and all the rest of it. But And of course, a lot of this is actually true. A lot of this was really what was going on in 1962. The Russians did have spy rings in Western intelligence. The Russians were trying to get nuclear missiles into Cuba. But, you know, what is missing from this story? What has been critically edited out of this story? Can you guess? Can you think of the missing factor here that I'm driving at?
Tell me. I don't know.
Operation Mongoose, the U.S., covert operation that it was trying to use to topple Castro or assassinate Castro or just generally cause lots of trouble in Cuba, that is completely edited out of this story. There is no mention of it whatsoever. And even in 1967, people did know about this. People did know that it was going on. If you've seen, obviously you've seen the film JFK and all of that, that of gets course. Into Mongoose and in Cuba and all the rest of it. So that is a very straightforward example of how a spy story can be very much based in reality, very much talking about real things, but be judiciously editing of history in order to portray a certain, you know, view to the public. So, okay, slightly different angle and slightly earlier period. Do you know the author Somerset Maugham? You studied English. You must know the name.
I know the name. I haven't read any Maugham.
That's good enough. That's good enough. Well, he was a early 20th century, sort of first half of the 20th century author. And he was actually working for MI6 during the First World War. And one of the curious things about this is he then in the 1920s wrote a sort of spy memoir, but a fictionalized spy memoir of his time working for MI6 in Russia, in Switzerland, in all the rest of it. And they seem to have absolutely no problem with this story. It's not the best read. I mean, he admits in the foreword to this book that he is trying to sort of condense down the rather dull spy work into something more exciting to actually get some drama out of it and get some theatre out of it. So where this gets a little bit kind of odd, or where it starts to fit into this whole notion of predictive programming, is when the Second World War starts and you have the Ministry of Information, basically the Ministry of Propaganda, and yes, it was actually called the Ministry of Information, and yes, that is just like in the Orwell book. And they were responsible for affecting public mood, not just in Britain with the domestic population, but also our foreign enemies and foreign allies' populations. And among the broadcasts, among the programs that they made to try and accomplish this propaganda aim was an adaptation of some of Maugham's Ashenden spy stories. So what we can establish from this, what we can be certain about in terms of what was happening in 1939, 1940, is that they were using spy stories for propagandistic purposes. Part of this was related to the whole secrecy of the spy agencies and the military agencies and all of that. And also that they were doing this in a preemptive fashion, because there is a report written by the military chiefs of staff for the Minister of Information where they say that we need to constantly be preempting what the next stage in the war is going to be, both in terms of likely enemy action and in terms of our action, and that our propaganda should be tailored around this kind of aim. Now, if they were doing that in 1940, is it so radical and so strange an idea that they might be doing it with programs like, I don't know, The X-Files or Spooks or 24 or any of these other sort of conspiracy-themed entertainment shows in the 21st century? I don't think it is such a radical idea at all. And as I said at the top, you know, when you actually look into this, there's an awful lot of it going on, so much that it can't just be a coincidence. You know, one program predicting an event could be anything. You know, it could be a coincidence, could not be. But when you've got 5, 6, a dozen programs predicting an event, I don't put that much faith in statistical probability, but that's an argument I do make. If there's a dozen programs predicting an event, they can't all be coincidences. And this is what we find with 7-7. And we discussed before how in these various shows, it's mainly episodes of Spooks, but also other BBC series. It's always the BBC. No other channel makes these predictive programs with regard to 7-7. It's only the BBC. They didn't just predict 7-7 in the sense of the official version, where you've got 4 Muslim suicide bombers, and they're the criminals, and they're the ones responsible for it. It also predicted it in terms of some of the alternative conspiracy theories, where you have an episode with a Muslim suicide bomber who is they try and stop him using an Algerian double agent. So we immediately get into the sort of the realm of double agents and informants and moles and all of that. They also had an episode where MI5 stage an attack on a London underground station. Sorry, a London train station. It's both overground and underground. And there is another one where a exercise, a training emergency management response exercise, is being run, and in the middle of the exercise being run, an attack happens. So even that dimension of 7-7, which has drawn so much attention in the alternative, you know, in the conspiracy theorist media, a lot of people have focused on this Peter Power exercise on 7-7. So these programs didn't just, you know, preempt the official version, they also sort of preempted the alternative versions. And I found this, what struck me from it is that this is exactly what you would do in this day and age if you were going to pull something like this off, is you wouldn't just create patsies and create an official narrative to be put out through the mainstream media. You would also try and create a few things to throw people off guard and send people in the wrong direction in the alternative media or in, you know, independent researchers like myself or, you know, whoever, whatever sort of person you are that's sort of engaged in all of this. I can't be certain that that's what they're doing because I can't prove who is doing this and exactly why. But that was the sort of response, that being intellectually honest about this, that's what I saw in these programs. I can't deny that it wasn't just the official version that was preempted. It was some of the alternative versions too.
Well, I think that would be one of the logical possibilities here when we start looking at how this functions. So they're trying to implant some sort of idea that they can then use to throw people off who are skeptical about whatever the official version is. I understand that. But there are other alternatives. I mean, without even getting into the poker match of, well, if we put this in there and then we actually do it that way, then they'll think it's just a TV show or whatever. But how about, just from a more skeptical point of view, so to speak, how about the possibility that this is not something that is being consciously implanted as a type by the perpetrators or people associated with the perpetrators in some way? What if this is something that is being, that's kind of a meme or an idea that's being picked up on? Obviously, we saw what happened in 9/11, and Muslim terrorism has been such a big point. So they make this show about spooks about the intelligence agents in Britain. Obviously, it's going to concentrate on the possibility of Islamic terrorism, which has been in the air,
so to speak.
So they make these programs. And what if there is some sort of copycat effect where, as we know, when something is portrayed in the media over and over and over and driven home like that, it tends to become a reality insofar as the people who are watching it, it can actually give ideas, it can foster ideas that might not otherwise have been so much thought of as a possibility. So radical Muslims, if we wanted to go down that route, could be watching these programs and starting to think, well, maybe it's possible, maybe we should be doing these types of things. Or, I mean, that's a very simplified version of the argument, but something along the lines of a copycat effect rather than some sort of perpetrators making the media, so to speak.
Well, I would sort of return to some extent to my previous argument of the sheer number of programs make that difficult to accept just straight off. It may well be true. There may well not be a conspiratorial effect here that is producing, in some way, producing these storylines, producing these programs, of course. But I would say I'm not rejecting that, but my doubt about it is caused by the fact that you do have so many different programs doing this. Of course, you would expect spooks to some extent to cover the subject, to deal with the subject of Islamic terrorism. And they do, frequently. In fact, so much that it's actually quite racist, particularly when the cast of Spooks is almost all white. They're all white spies, apart from one, who then gets killed and gets replaced by another sort of token ethnic minority character. It's not particularly subtle when you've got a bunch of handsome, white, young spooks running around, you know, getting these evil, ugly Asian terrorists. But I accept what you're saying. There is an effect here whereby certain memes or certain tropes kind of, once they're out there, they then, to some extent, do take on a kind of semiotic life of their own, where they just turn up in strange places and in strange combinations. So this is very much a possibility. And actually, I don't know if you know about this, I did a radio show that I actually presented on Sunday night. I've started to do a radio show on the Resistance Radio website. It's just for a trial thing. I'm just sort of going to try it out and see how I like it. And to be honest, the first show was a little bit of a car crash, but...
well, I hope people don't go back and listen to my first show. That's all I can say.
Well, exactly. The first time you do anything, it's usually you learn from it anyway. that's the main thing. So... And one of the clips that I played on that show was from the a kind of Spooks commentary slash production feature from the DVDs, because in this this series 2 episode, and this broadcast I think in 2003, so a couple of years before 7/7, and you have this episode with a Muslim suicide bomber, and this caused a bit of outrage at the time. There were quite a lot of complaints to the BBC. There was quite a lot of accusations that this was a sort of, you know, a bit of a racist program. And to be honest, I can... earphone cable is playing silly buggers. I can see where people are coming from with that, because it really is a horrible scenario, and it's not like they've portrayed anyone else as being potential suicide bombers. It's only Muslims. When, of course, at that period in time, the vast majority, not vast majority, but certainly the statistical majority of suicide bombings in history by 2002, 2003, were actually carried out by Tamil Tigers, not by Muslims. That is just statistical evidence, even if one accepts the official versions of all these events whereby Muslims have apparently carried out suicide bombings. Even if one accepts all of those, still, statistically, it wasn't as common for Muslims to carry these out as Tamils. So... there is a certain degree of prejudice there that the particularly Muslim British population complained about and kind of were against. So on the DVD, when they released the DVD, they made a little production feature about that episode where they have members of the cast and writer and director of the show kind of coming up talking about this, but also trying to give some excuses for why they sort of had to cover this sort of storyline and blah, blah, blah. And actually, one of the actors said... in fact, the only non-white actor in that series of Spooks says when he first sort of read the script and when he was first sort of talking about this story, the idea that flashed into him was, let's not put ideas in people's heads. Let's not be inspiring people to do something that they haven't already done. And it is always possible, you know, if... I mean, I don't think those four guys did it with 7/7. You know that. I think... well, actually, some people don't seem to know that. Some people seem to think that I do actually think they did it, but, you know, you get misinterpreted. But let's suppose, for the sake of argument and for the sake of charitableness, that it is possible that they could have done it. Could they have been inspired by the fact that every time suicide bombings are mentioned in Spooks, or every time they are portrayed as being done by Muslims? It's possible... but like I say, I don't think they did it, so that's a bit of a kind of non sequitur. But nonetheless, there is a whole other dimension to this, and this is sort of what I mentioned in my email, is that you don't just have them predicting official conspiracy theories and alternative conspiracy theories about forthcoming events. You also have what this sort of normalization process, whereby everything that these spooks are doing is portrayed in a benevolent way. And this goes beyond just the kind of James Bond portrayal of spies, where he's, you know, sexy and glamorous and he's in these exotic locations with beautiful women and he's drinking and eating exotic food and it's all, you know, tremendously exciting and tremendously glamorous. And he's, you know, he's almost a celebrity spy, which if you think about it is kind of a contradiction in terms. It's the last thing that you'd actually want your spy to be is this
Chapman.
Rather... yeah, Eddie Chapman, exactly. I mean, the truth is, quite a lot of spies are actually quite like that, but it kind of runs counter to the whole notion of being a covert agent. But in Spooks, we see it goes beyond that. It goes to the benevolence of these organizations, the benevolence of their methods, the benevolence of their way of thinking, that even when they do sort of slightly corrupting things like employ a terrorist as an informant or, you know, use face matching software or any of the other kind of technological apparatus that spies have these days every time they use CCTV. It's always done for a benevolent purpose. It's always at the very, very worst, it's a necessary evil. Most of the time, it is just portrayed as, look how cool and funky and great it is that we live in this world where, you know, if you're trying to track someone through London, you can follow their mobile phone and get their CCTV and you know, all the rest of it. And this is...
Except when the CCTVs are all not working, but...
Which is mysteriously the case whenever there's a terrorist attack. Yeah. So you have the national security state being advanced and being normalized through these programs as well. And that isn't necessarily a predictive thing, because a lot of this stuff obviously already exists. A lot of this technology is already being used by our spy services. And so what I wonder about this, or what I kind of... the pattern that kind of jumps out at me is that as we've moved into an era where, in particular in Britain, the existence of these agencies and to some extent what they actually do is no longer a rigidly kept secret. Because it was from 1945 until 1992, MI6 officially did not exist. They would not admit that it even existed, let alone comment on what the hell it was up to. And MI6 is basically our equivalent of the CIA. It is a much larger agency than MI5. It is presumably the agency that we use primarily when we're getting involved in foreign countries in covert ways, like Libya, Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, wherever. Not to be flippant, but there's a lot of different countries where we've done it. So they are... It is the equivalent of them denying that the CIA existed for the whole of the Cold War, which is, to Americans, unthinkable. It's bizarre. They've sort of always known that the CIA existed from its inception in, was it 47, I think they actually founded the CIA properly. It was always kind of known that it existed. And whereas, returning to the Hitchcock thing, what is the first film... where the CIA is mentioned openly, where it is named. It is, of course, a Hitchcock film. It's North by Northwest. I only found that out the other day, so I'm you know, I'm showing off.
It's an interesting tidbit, though.
Whereas in the Bond films, you'll notice they don't actually say that he works for MI6. They don't name MI6. It's obvious he works for MI6, and anyone watching it can tell that, but they don't name that. The first time MI6 is mentioned in one of the Bond films is in 1995, i.e. after it had been publicly admitted that they existed. So you have a sort of a tension here, and that's why it's difficult to understand it properly and why I'm not pushing too hard a conclusion as to what's going on here. You have a tension between... they're trying to sort of keep these things secret, or at least classified, restricted in some to some extent. And that obviously is still going on. You were talking the other day about Sybil Edmonds as the sort of most classified woman in US history. And I think, much as that's a slightly silly tag, it's an accurate one. It is an accurate one. It is remarkable the extent that they've gone to, the effort that they've gone to silence her, to prevent what she said and what she's actually already put on the record from being read by people and from being heard by people. But at the same time, we live in a sort of almost unprecedented era of television filmmaking that deals with these agencies and deals with people like Sybil Edmonds. Her sort of story, they'll be quite happy to put it out as fiction, as long as it's fiction that, again, helps normalize the national security state, helps normalize that agenda. They would never actually put out a sort of proper version of her story, because even as fiction, I think people would be outraged by it, and quite rightly. So you have this tension between sort of, on the one hand, trying to keep these things relatively quiet and relatively covert, if not secret, but on the other hand, you've admitted that they exist. You've got to do something with people's impressions and suspicions and questions. You have to respond to that in some kind of a way. So rather than respond to it by actually telling people what the hell is going on, or even what the hell was going on 30, 40 years ago, it seems that they use the fiction It's the sort of the logic that in my book that I'm writing on 7/7, I've actually been writing the section that's all about exercises and television programs and predictions of 7/7 in the last week or so. And looking over all this material, the kind of logic that leapt out at me is basically ban the fact, censor the facts, use the fiction. That seems to be the pattern, that, you know, don't actually tell anyone what you're really up to, but instead portray it through something that is one step removed, that is fictionalized, so that, for one thing, you can maintain this farce that, oh, MI5 doesn't actually do these things. MI5 doesn't actually assassinate people or carry out acts of terrorism or kidnap people or blackmail people or, you know, torture people or whatever. Of course they do. We know that they do. Even though they keep denying it officially, we know that they do because there's so much evidence of it. But nonetheless, in the official MI5 kind of almost, I don't know quite what to call it, I suppose it's an official history of MI5 that came out a year or two ago to, it's actually about celebrating the centenary of these agencies. They talk about spooks and they talk about the Bond films and they say, you know, actually there are some things that are portrayed very accurately in spooks, but the one thing they really portray inaccurately is that these people act outside of the law and that they act as though they have a license to kill. But actually sometimes they do, and we know that they do. So we seem to have moved from this bizarre doublethink of denying that the agencies exist even when everyone bloody knows that they exist. That's one kind of doublethink. We've now moved into a kind of second phase of that where they're admitting that the agencies exist. So the debate is about what are they up to? What are they doing? Why do they make decisions in the way that they make them? And so we're now moving into the era of a kind of moral rather than existential doublethink, where they're telling us, oh no, we don't actually do these things. We don't actually do any of these horrible kinds of activities. We don't actually get involved in all of those. But at the same time, every once in a while, they have to admit that, in fact, they do get involved in these kinds of things. It was only a few months back, you had the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland standing up in the House of Commons saying, yes, there were state collusion with loyalist terrorists. I accidentally said Republicans the last time I was on your show, and I apologise for that. That was a mistake. I misspoke. No, Patrick Finucane, the lawyer, was killed by loyalist terrorists in collusion with the British state. And they've admitted this 22, 23 years too late, but they've had to actually admit it at the same time as denying it. So you see, again, we have a kind of doublethink about all of this, that we are presented, that's their kind of resolution for this tension of wanting it to be secret, but knowing that in an information age that's unrealistic. Their solution to that is a sort of moral doublethink.
Well, that's fascinating, and obviously it raises so many different possibilities and interpretations and ways that you could expand the analysis, but I think certainly it's quite obvious that putting things into a fictional form does present that sort of externalization of the hierarchy or whatever you want to call it, in which it becomes a sort of lived reality because we've all experienced it in our own living rooms from the comfort of our sofa or whatever it is, that we start to accept ideas that we otherwise would find abnormal. So if we read a newspaper report about how police used the cell phones to track an individual, it's obviously quite different than if we see it just portrayed in a fictional setting. And we are more inclined to, I think, just accept it. So that is interesting, but I think also another way that that analysis could proceed is in this day and age, it's not necessarily going to be presented in a fictionalized form. So I'm thinking specifically about reality TV shows that are now focusing, obviously, I think one of the first ones that most people would think of is Cops from the US, which was a wildly popular show just following cops around. And basically the inevitable narrative trajectory of an episode of Cops would be, you know, the good-hearted cop goes around and finally finds some bumbling, complete idiot, and they take him down, and everyone's rooting for the cop because the guy is such a total moron or whatever the case may be in that particular instance. But basically, that was the standard go-to. And I've noticed in recent years, obviously, I'm completely out of the media loop here in Japan, and thankfully so in a lot of ways, but it does mean that I can't analyze this quite as well. But I have seen in recent years there is an Australian show that's coming out that focuses on border patrol agents, so people examining at airports and everything, just, you know, checking passengers. And I don't know, I haven't seen enough to be able to say, but what I have seen of it, it seems to be that case where it's either stupid people trying to bring stupid things into the country because they're so stupid, so, you know, good guards looking at stupid people, or it's extremely shady and suspicious people, and the guards are all you know, they're hesitant to want to do anything with this individual, but oh well, he's really suspicious, I think we'll have to pull him aside for extra screening. So I can see the way that would be used, and again, I haven't seen enough of that to actually be able to pronounce on it, but I think that might be another way in which this could be seeping into people's consciousness.
Absolutely. And think back to the sort of the most successful, or almost the paradigm establishing reality TV show, which is, of course, Big Brother, called, without irony, Big Brother. Very strange. But what does that do? It is effectively us, the audience, the general public, sitting at home spying on people. That's what the entertainment is derived from. You've got all these CCTV cameras stuck up in this, you know, this mocked up house. They stick a bunch of people in there, knowing that there's enough of a cross section that sooner or later it'll create a bit of fiction and a bit of drama, and that's what they tend to focus on. I think most people grasp that, but what I don't think most people grasp is the extent of their own voyeurism in watching this bloody stuff. That we are, and that happens in this country. I can't remember when the first series was, but it was probably around the turn of the century, 99, 2000, something like that. And it was only a couple of years later that you started getting these trial CCTV projects in different boroughs in London, whereby there would be a satellite TV channel that you could, you know, turn, you know, press the button on your remote, and you can get a live CCTV feed from your neighborhood. So you can sit there trying to spot the criminals and then phone up the police and tell them. And so it's, you know, it's drawing us all into this voyeuristic kind of mutual spying state where you don't even need the secret services to be running around doing this stuff. They've actually got to the stage where people, ordinary people, are starting to do it for them. And this not only sort of normalizes this kind of thing, it also, it's really unpleasant. I mean, who wants to live with that kind of paranoia and suspicion in their lives? What kind of a person actually sits there at home watching CCTV on their television, on their satellite box, trying to spot a bloody criminal? I mean, what kind of an activity is that for a human being, with all the things that human beings are capable of doing, with all of the kind of ingenuity and energy and imagination that human beings have, that they spend that their time doing that? It's shocking, really. But yeah, talking about reality TV, one of the things I flagged up on my website in a recent article called Spook Publicity, which is sort of all about this, or all about some aspects of this, was a 2004, so pre-77, bit of television, again by the BBC, who else, called Spy, which is a reality TV show in the classic reality TV format, where it's a bit like a game show. Well, it is basically a game show, where they get, I think, 10 members of the public, and they train them to be spies. They get 3 ex-spooks, you know, one MI6, one CIA, one from somewhere else, and they put them through a series of challenges and tests and ordeals, and basically train them to be intelligence agents, undercover agents. And in the very first episode, they kidnap these people in the middle of the night. They drag them off to some warehouse somewhere, stick bags over their heads. They're in the freezing cold. They're shining lights in their faces. They're bellowing at them. They're being very, you know, aggressive and unpleasant towards these people. And I think one of the contestants actually dropped out at that point and said, you know, this is too much for me. I didn't sign up for this. I didn't think this is what was going to happen to me. And this is being presented as entertainment. We're supposed to be sat at home laughing at this, or at least being, you know, enthralled by it to some extent. And again, we see this notion of kind of normalizing these behaviors, but not just normalizing them in the hands of the trainers, in the hands of the official ex-spooks that are kind of running the show, presenting the show. As the program progresses, the underlying message, the underlying lesson for these young people, mostly our young people, is you have to leave your moral conscience at home. You have to forget about what you think is right and wrong, and about your feelings of repulsion at what we're asking you to do in, you know, spying on your friends or spying on your family or breaking into someone's house or whatever it is that they're telling them to do. And you have to just get on with it, because that is the game that's being played here. So you've talked before about this notion of a sort of moral collapse, that something that we are to some extent being prepped and kind of prodded towards is this notion of kind of absolute relativism, absolute individualism, the almost psychopathic morality of I just do what is good for me, or even just what I perceive is good for me in this instance, and I don't care about any of the consequences for anything else. And one of the places that I can very much see this happening in is with this kind of predictive programming, this, you know, spy shows in particular that do this, because they are very much putting us in a position whereby the voyeuristic state, the eternal suspicion state, is kind of, we're being pushed to a point where that is the default state of mind for people, where that is actually how they're being told that they should perceive the world.
Absolutely right. And in that, the act of watching itself, just the act of passively consuming that media, makes you part of that process, and in fact, in some way indoctrinates you into the system. It draws you into it. So yeah. in an interesting way, I mean, I would assume that black operations and things that are done by intelligence agencies that are, shall we say, morally questionable, would be perpetrated by people.
If not downright immoral.
If not downright immoral, exactly. Would be perpetrated by people who had been sort of drawn into the system. One could imagine the way that that people would be prepped in the role of intelligence agent by slight transgressions, and if the person was willing to push the boundary here, well, maybe we can give them this task and they'll go a little bit further. Mm. One could imagine that type of process. In that way, the people who are watching this type of spy game show or whatever are in effect engaged in that, so that by the end, the people who are still watching and who think that this is entertainment, in a way, have bought into that system and are saying, well, those, mm-hmm. It's just a game. It's just a TV show. It's transgression. Yeah, it's wrong. It's transgression. But, you know, it's in the name of good fun or whatever. So in a certain way, they've invested part of their identity in that type of activity.
Yeah, we are spying on people being trained to be spies, and they are spying on someone else themselves. We are spying on someone spying on someone. How have we got to this point? You know, how have we got to the point in human history where that's what we're spending our time doing? And I've got to admit, I watched that program. I watched every episode of it, not as entertainment, but there were occasional bits in it that I did find entertaining. I can't deny that. I can see why people watched it. I can see why they made the show. I can see how it attracted an audience. But at the same time, I do find it a bit kind of not just morally questionable, but in some places morally repulsive. And we're coming up on time. Just to throw another little kind of dimension into this. There is I think it's by The Onion, in fact, I'm pretty sure it must be by The Onion, a video that they did where they're describing how the mainstream media have bombed a plane in order to demonstrate how security isn't working. And this is obviously a satirization and a play on this notion of how, oh, well, we were just doing it for a TV program. We wouldn't do this normally. But, you know, because we're doing it for a TV program, there's no problem with getting someone to cheat on their girlfriend or do whatever it is that we've managed to manipulate this person into the position of doing for the sake of a reality TV show. It's not just a play and a satirization on that, but the very fact of The Onion satirizing it and us laughing at it, again, to some extent, normalizes it. So this is not just something that's taking place in reality TV and so on and so forth. It's also taking place in satire, in comedy, in commentary on this.
Exactly right. In fact, we could do an entire conversation just on The Onion and all of, I mean, there's so many things to get into just with that alone. But as you say, we are running out of time. Unfortunately, I have to run along to another interview. I could really talk about this for hours. But before I let you go, I think I have to ask you about, I know that you gave me some feedback that you'd listened to my recent podcast episode on Sirhan Sirhan, and this revolved around some of these ideas of fiction and reality, and one informs the other, which then informs the other again. And it was quite a lot of different tales kind of weaved together. But one that I found particularly head-scratching was the Manchurian Candidate connection with John Frankenheimer directing the 1962 film based on a novel that itself was based on the MK Ultra CIA experiments about trying to create and program a killer. And the Frankenheimer film came out in 1962, but of course, in the wake of the Kennedy assassination, everyone was quite uneasy about that type of plot. So it was basically withdrawn from circulation. No one ever saw it again for, I can't even remember, 30 years or something. And then Frankenheimer himself, the director of The Manchurian Candidate, was the person who was with RFK on the day that he was shot. He spent the day at the house. They had dinner together. He drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, and he was going to take him to a night spot after Kennedy met with the press. He ends up dying. Just a bizarre tale that connects and interweaves in numerous ways. I'd just like to get your general take on that and what you found interesting or any thoughts you had on that.
Well, certainly, I think our suspected assassin was not a conventional assassin in any way. His whole story doesn't make sense if he's just some, you know, crank. And actually, very quickly, it reminds me of you were talking about The Society of the Spectacle, this magnificent philosophical work in the late 60s, I think it was. And I was actually reading Du Bois' comments that he wrote on his own book sort of 20 years later. I was reading this quite recently, and he mentions this idea of how it's possible to write a book and cause an assassination by writing a book. And I don't think he was talking about the Manchurian Candidate and the Robert Kennedy assassination. I think he's probably more referring to Catchers in the Rye and Mark Chapman, what's his name, the guy who shot Reagan, who apparently these guys, not that they necessarily did it, but these guys were all known for having read Catcher in the Rye. So you very much have this world whereby, because we're so uncertain exactly what did physically happen in these events, in some ways what we're left with are these conflicting simulations, these conflicting theoretical and speculative possibilities, but all of which are kind of, not always, but often preempted in books and in fiction and in cinema and all the rest of it. So we, basically my general take on this is we have to be clever. We have to be very clever about this, because if this is a real phenomenon and the evidence very much suggests it's a real phenomenon, then those bastards are very clever. And so we have to be very clever in response in trying to investigate them and ultimately, you know, have these institutions abolished and have these people prosecuted. And I think we have to be far smarter than we have been, generally speaking, throughout, you know, the last however many years, however many decades you want to talk about counterculture movements and radical politics existing. I think when people look into this, they should look into it not just in terms of conspiracy theories and what the alternative media will tell them and all of those kinds of things, but also they should get a bit of a background in things like linguistics and semiotics and psychology, because without those tools, you can't really make sense of any of this, of any of the how these fictions, some of them are real possibilities. And to be able to make that leap, I think you need a bit more knowledge than you will just get from, you know, from those sources.
That is a wise admonition, and I hope people will take it to heart, because absolutely it applies not only in this, but of course in many other fields. But I agree completely. I think we do need to start examining this at a deeper level, because there's something going on here, and I think we really need to start taking a look at this. And as I say, I could talk about this for hours and hours, but unfortunately I have to get going. So Tom Secker, I certainly hope you'll be on the program again in the future to talk more about this and at greater
length. I certainly will, James. Certainly will.
All right. Once again, throw out the website and tell us about any other things that you may have on the go.
Well, the website is investigatingtheterror.com, which has all my videos, all my presentations, lots and lots of source documents and things that I've started posting up there from my researches from the last few years. And my main project on the go at the moment is a thorough, broad-ranging book on 7/7 that covers not just these dimensions that we've been talking about today, but the failures of the police investigations, the failures of the mainstream and alternative media to investigate this properly, and basically where we can go from here, what kinds of evidence might give us some answers to these questions. And it's just going to be a huge consolidation of everything I've been doing on 7/7 and a bunch of new material for the last however many years it is that I've been looking into this.
Excellent. Well, I certainly can't wait for that. And I certainly can't wait for the book on spy pigeons that will be coming along shortly thereafter. No? Okay. Oh, I hope people will go and check out the Spy Pigeon article. But at any rate, Tom Zucker, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James.